Welcome. This is William Evans, and you're listening to Shifting Gears. Our guest today is Sandra Hempel, speaking with us from London. Sandra is a medical journalist and the author of two works of particular interest to our conversation today, and they are both about water and a London physician, John Snow, born in 1813. Welcome, Sandra.
Thank you very much, Will. It's a great pleasure to be talking to you.
Well, it's an amazing feat of technology to be talking to you. Tell us, what was England like in the 1800s?
Well, it was a place of great contrast, really, and not a few divisions. Great contrast, particularly between the rich and the poor, because it was the center at that time, of course, of a great empire. And the British at that time were also a great trading and a great manufacturing nation. But at the same time, we have millions of people living a terrible hand-to-mouth existence and living in squalor. And so the huge technological advances that were going on at that time, what was known here as the Industrial Revolution, involved the growth of mechanization and of the railways. In many ways, was a mixed blessing, and it threw lots of people out of work, and the working conditions of those who were in work and their living conditions were often absolutely appalling. And I think Charles Dickens, writing in the mid-19th century, really exposed a lot of these issues and the situation that these people found themselves in.
The best of times and the worst of times.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And in those days, where did the water supply for London come from?
From two sources. There were pump wells in the streets, and these were fed from underground streams. And then there was water supplied by private companies who pumped water directly into people's homes. Both sources were very badly contaminated, filthy, actually. And the pump wells were often polluted by sewage from privies and from sewers leaking into the system. And the water companies were taking their water direct from the Thames, River Thames in central London, and right next to the spot where the sewers were being discharged. And they were just pumping this stuff completely unfiltered and untreated into people's homes.
Right. Wow.
So it's actually quite astounding that far more people weren't ill than actually were ill.
We've been reminded in this country that source water is life, and we are mostly water.
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. As you know, I mean, water is a nutrient, and as you say, it's essential for life, but it also can be a carrier of potentially deadly diseases like cholera, dysentery, and typhoid if it becomes contaminated.
Right. And in that day, most physicians and most of the public believed that disease traveled in the air, and they trusted their sense of smell to determine if something was unhealthy.
They did. I mean, obviously, as we know now, some diseases are spread through the air, such as influenza, for example. But they specifically believed at that time that bad smells and gases, what they called miasma, that was given off by waste material such as rotting food, they believed that those bad gases actually carried a poison within them that made people ill. And before we understood about germs, I think this is a perfectly reasonable idea, because there is indeed a link between dirt and therefore bad smells and disease. But of course, for centuries, nobody actually understood what that link was until we had Pasteur putting in the missing piece of the jigsaw, if you like, and putting forward his germ theory.
And this was right at the time when people and their leaders were still unaware that the humble, accepting nature of water requires sewage and source water to be carefully separated.
Yeah, they, you're right. They didn't. They really didn't understand that at all, and that was why we had this absolutely London in particular, and in fact, in all of Britain, cities and towns, we had this filthy, filthy water.
Right, and what made that issue so compelling was that cholera made its way by ship to England.
It did. It did. I mean, there were three huge cholera pandemics in the 19th century when the disease moved from its traditional home in the Ganges Delta in India, first across India and then across the world. But during the first pandemic, it arrived in northeast England in 1831 on a ship from Hamburg in Germany, where the disease was then rife.
Right.
And at that time, there was a huge trade across the North Sea between the Baltic ports of Germany and the ports on the northeast coast of England. And so it was inevitable, really, I think, once cholera reached Hamburg, that it was going to cross the North Sea and land in England.
And tell us now, who was John Snow?
John Snow, as you mentioned at the beginning, was an English physician who was born in 1813. And he came from a very humble background. We don't know quite how he managed to pay for his medical education, but it's thought he was probably paid for by a wealthy uncle, because his parents really didn't have any money at all. His father was a labourer, but he managed to get this medical education. He came to London from Yorkshire, where he grew up, and established himself there as a physician. And it was during this time that he worked out how cholera was being spread, and he did it by careful observation and worked out a theory. But because his theory was so outlandish and revolutionary at the time, sadly, nobody believed him. And had they done so, then thousands, if not millions of lives could have been saved, because had they accepted his theory, they would have known how to prevent the disease from spreading. The idea was that it was waterborne.
Right. And as a result, he's known as the forefather of epidemiology.
Absolutely, because his groundbreaking research was not, as we might normally think about research, being done in a laboratory, but it was actually on the ground, in the streets, talking to people, asking questions, collecting data, and tracking how cholera was actually being spread, how it behaved on the ground. And that's really the fundamentals of epidemiology.
And he started that work of his own in the summer of 1854 to test this theory in his grand experiment on the streets of South London.
He did. He discovered a way of proving his waterborne theory, which, when you first think about it, is quite a difficult idea to prove. How do you go about this? But he noticed that households in South London were served by two different water companies. And in a cholera epidemic in 1848, both of those companies were taking their water straight from the River Thames, as I've already mentioned, in central London, where the water was absolutely disgusting. But in 1852, one of those companies moved its works to a rural location where the river was far, far cleaner and where it was out of the reach of the sewage of London. So when cholera broke out again in 1854, Snow decided that he would compare the number of cholera deaths between the customers from the two water companies during the first epidemic in 1848 with the customers in 1854, and he would see if anything had changed over that period when one water company moved to supplying cleaner water. And his result, it was a huge experiment because it involved clogging the streets, knocking on doors, and saying to householders, which company supplies your water, and did anybody die of cholera in your house? He actually, in the end, had to hire a couple of people to help him because it was such a massive job. But finally, he got all his data together, and when he compared it, he found when the two companies were both supplying polluted water, the death rates between the customers from cholera were the same. But in 1854, the customers who were getting the clean water were more than seven times less likely to die than the customers who were still getting the sewage contaminated water. So that's why it was called a grand experiment. And it was the first time anyone had tried anything along those lines or even thought of doing so. And it's iconic today. It's still celebrated among epidemiologists.
And the reaction of the medical community and the public didn't demonstrate much trust in what John Snow told them.
Actually, they mainly totally ignored it. That was the main reaction. People just didn't pick up on it at all. And, I mean, to be fair, there were masses of different theories being put forward all the time. People were so baffled by cholera that there were just hundreds of suggestions for how it was being spread and how we might treat it. But nobody picked up on the fact that, unlike most of the other theories, this one was actually based on solid scientific research. Anyone who did take any notice of it, and they were within the medical profession, ridiculed him largely. And said that the whole thing was just bizarre and ridiculous and that he was a madman with an obsession. But he persisted. I mean, he refused to be cowed by the hostility and the contempt that he was faced with. He was convinced he was right. So he just continued to argue his case.
And what happened on August 31st, 1854, in the Soho district of London?
That was extraordinary. That night, in a part of a tiny area known as Soho in the centre of London, and this is just a few lanes we're talking about, over 200 people went down with cholera, and many of them died overnight. And people who were there described it as being like a biblical plague that suddenly swept through. And there were terrible stories of children waking up the next morning to find both of their parents were dead, and they had become orphans overnight. And this outbreak continued for the next 10 days before it finally petered out, by which time the death toll stood at 600, and the authorities were just overwhelmed. They had to set up a makeshift morgue in the area to cope with the number of bodies. And another odd thing about it to everyone was that this most virulent outbreak was entirely contained within that little patch of lanes. It didn't spread anywhere. So the whole thing was extraordinary.
And John Snow trusted himself, even though he didn't have public or medical support, that he walked into a parish meeting at the St. James Church where the Board of Guardians were discussing this cholera outbreak. And what did he tell them to do?
He told them that they had to take the handle off the pump in Broad Street. Broad Street was in the center of this epidemic.
And this was the Broad Street pump we hear about in all the stories that we get in this country about the cholera epidemic.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely, it is the Broad Street pump, and there is a pump, a replica pump, in Broad Street. It's now changed its name to Broadwick Street, but it's the same street. and there is a replica pump there. It's not on exactly the same spot. It's just across the road, but it's there. It's very iconic, actually, that image.
And what happened when he told the Board of Guardians to take the handle off the pump?
Well, they didn't believe him, and there were accounts afterwards of some of the guardians saying, we just didn't believe him, we found him very unconvincing. However, at that time, they were so desperate, and also they thought they had nothing to lose, so they decided to, in their view, they were almost humouring him, but they did take his advice, they did go along with it, and the handle did come off the pump.
And you've recorded the historical details of this story in The Strange Case of the Broad Street Pump, published by the University of California Press in 2007.
Yes, that's right. Yes, I thought it was a fascinating story altogether and that he was a fascinating man. So yes, I wrote a book about it.
You're listening to Shifting Gears and a conversation with Sandra Hempel about waterborne disease and John Snow, a physician, in 1850 London. In 2013, England marked the bicentennial of John Snow's birth and his work, and you published in the International Journal of Epidemiology an article very concisely describing the facts as well as acknowledging John Snow and cholera and how myth helped secure his place in history. Tell us the mythic story of John Snow and the Broad Street Pump.
Okay. The mythical story is that John Snow personally removed the pump handle himself, and some accounts also have him storming out of the parish meeting, losing his temper because the guardians wouldn't believe him, and immediately marching round and wrenching the handle off the pump or locking it up, one or the other. And the story goes on that immediately the handle was removed, the death toll plunged overnight, and Snow's theory was therefore proven overnight in the same way. And it's a wonderful dramatic tale, and it's very easy to see why it's so widely believed and passed into the sort of public consciousness, as it were. But as is so often the case in life, the situation was a little bit more complex than that. And as I mentioned earlier, while the guardians didn't actually think that Snow was right, they did do as he said, and they had the handle taken off. But also, by that time, they were 7 days into this epidemic, and the death toll had already started to drop of its own accord. So, in fact, taking that handle off the pump didn't really prove anything.
Well, that's certainly the version of the story I was taught in 1963 when I entered medical school in this country.
Right.
So it's been fascinating for me to carry that power and that imagery because something about it resonates about the mythic call that can sing to us and try and wake up our essence and engage with what's happening in the world today. And yet the reality is there's a lot of lonely hard work that John Snow carried forward, and that's what it takes. The mythic call is supported by, as you say, the shoe leather path doing the epidemiology.
Absolutely, absolutely. In my article, I argue that even, you know, though a myth involves distorting the facts or presenting them in a way that isn't quite right, but that, in this case, in my view, is actually no bad thing, because that story has done so much to grab people's imagination, to highlight the importance of John Snow's work, and also to highlight the incredible contribution that the science of epidemiology has made, and also continues to make, to our understanding of how epidemic diseases spread. And of course, when you can understand how they spread, you can start to think about how you might prevent them.
Right. And that led to the effective treatment of cholera.
Well, yes, yes, indeed. And the effective treatment of cholera is, I mean, if you get the treatment to the patient quickly enough, it is incredibly simple because cholera kills by dehydration. And so if you can rehydrate the body, get fluids back into the body fast enough, either by simple drinks or if someone's very seriously ill, by intravenously, by giving them intravenous fluids, you can bring someone back to life. I've heard it described sometimes as almost miraculously. You can watch somebody virtually, you know, get better and come back to life once this vital water has been pumped back into their body. But also, I mean, there's a vaccine, but it's not entirely effective, not very short, not very long lasting. And there are some drugs, but nothing is as effective as this fluid replacement, which, of course, they could easily have done even in the 19th century. With medicines, it was in those days, they could still easily have used it.
Yes. And so the greater life is found when destiny calls to us and we become who we are.
Yes. Yes. No, I was just going to say, and John Snow very much became who he was and how we remember him, I think, with the help of the myth.
And he lived far enough into his life to reveal the greater story, but never was recognized publicly or acknowledged because he died before that awareness had really reached the public level.
Yes, yes. And there was no great eureka moment where someone said, oh, good heavens, after all, he was right. It was just a very steady, steady, relentless piling up of the evidence in his favor that made people finally realize that he had been right all along. But he was a very, very modest man, and he really was not interested in glory or money. He was just interested in the scientific truth.
Yeah, he trusted his pursuit of the truth.
He did. And he was a very quiet, almost reclusive man, but because he was really absolutely convinced that he was right, nothing would shake him. And he continued to argue his case, no matter what, until he died. Very tragically, actually, in his 40s.
Well, like Jon Snow, it seems to be our fate to live during a time of great upheaval and sweeping change.
Indeed, indeed. There are lots of parallels that I can see.
Well, there are many ways dramatic changes are underway, and no easy way to see where life is going or how things may turn out.
Yes, always. Always. But I think the model of somebody who believes in something, who's done the work, actually done the hard work, and as a result of that, thinks that they really have are on to the truth and sticks with it no matter what and refuses to be intimidated or ridiculed or sidelined. I think that is, for me anyway, I mean, that's a huge inspiration, really.
Well, it is, because you felt quite deflated when you learned that Jon Snow didn't pull the pump handle.
Yes, I did. I was. And I was even more deflated to find out that removing a handle didn't prove his theory about cholera being waterborne overnight in a very dramatic way. But then when I thought about it, I realized that, of course, that didn't change one jot the magnitude of his achievement and his contribution to science. All of that was still there. It didn't change it. It was just... slightly wrong in the way that we thought the story ran.
So answering a mythic call may involve not deflating in the hard work.
Yes, absolutely. I think so.
Well, we live today on this ground of uncertainty in the face of the unknown, and yet Jon Snow reminds us that the inner story of our soul is pertinent And what you've done is factually share with us the monumental work he did, as well as live with the awareness of his mythic power. And for all of us, he shifted our understanding of source water in life-sustaining ways. Thank you, Sandra.
Pleasure. Absolute pleasure. Thank you.
You've been listening to Shifting Gears and a conversation with Sandra Hempel, author of The Strange Case of the Broad Street Pump. Speaking with us from London, this is KDNK. Thank you for listening.